Marcus.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Stephanie Marcus from the Department of Justice, and I represent Appellant Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of HHS. In this case, plaintiff Catholic Health Initiatives challenges its fiscal year 1997 disproportionate share hospital adjustment, known as the DISH adjustment. The DISH adjustment is calculated by adding two fractions, the Medicare SSI fraction, which is a proxy for the percentage of low-income Medicare patients, and the Medicaid fraction, which is a proxy for the percentage of low-income Medicaid patients. In this case, the district court accepted Catholic Health's argument that the patient days at issue, which are attributable to Medicare beneficiaries who are eligible for Medicaid and have exhausted their Medicare coverage for the particular hospital stay at issue, and these are what we refer to as dual eligible exhausted coverage days, that those belong in the Medicaid fraction. This decision is erroneous for several reasons. First and foremost, it is contrary to the plain meaning of the phrase entitled to benefits under Part A throughout the Medicare statute. The Secretary has consistently interpreted and Congress intended that the phrase entitled to benefits under Medicare Part A refers to an individual's legal status, not whether the Medicare program makes payment for a particular patient day. This court in Hall understood that entitlement does refer to whether an individual meets the age and disability requirements for being a Medicare beneficiary. It doesn't, in that case, the plaintiffs had argued that they were not entitled to Medicare Part A because they had disavowed any intention to claim Medicare benefits for the particular hospital stay. And if they don't request payment by Medicare, the hospital won't get Medicare payment. And this court said that no, they are entitled to benefits under Part A because they meet the criteria in sections 426A and B of the Act. And the other important point in this case is that when Congress expressly referred to exhausted coverage days in the Medicare statute, it made clear that it views the very individuals who are at issue here, those that are indisputably Medicare beneficiaries who have met those requirements, but who for particular patient days have exhausted their Medicare coverage, that they are entitled to benefits under Part A. And these are the statutes we cited in our brief. First, there's 42 U.S.C. 1395L-A8B, which refers to outpatient physical therapy services. And it says, if these services by a hospital to an outpatient or to a hospital inpatient who is entitled to benefits under Part A but has exhausted benefits for inpatient hospital services or is not so entitled to benefits under Part A. So, and then similarly in Section 1395LT1B, the Congress referred to patients who are entitled to benefits under Part A but have exhausted benefits for inpatient hospital services or not so entitled. So Congress itself, within the Medicare statute, has put Medicare beneficiaries who have exhausted coverage in the entitled to benefits category. And as this court recognized in the Agena case, there is a presumption that a phrase is used the same way throughout a statute. And here, a plaintiff has failed to rebut that presumption. And in addition, in the 28J letter that we sent you in Metropolitan Hospital, the court there declined plaintiff Metro's hospital suggestion that entitled to benefits under Part A should be somehow interpreted differently in the DISH provision. There, the court noted that the phrase appears in more than 30 other sections of the Medicare statute, indicating that it has a specific, consistent meaning throughout the statutory scheme rather than a varying context-specific meaning. And for that reason, we think that the district court's decision should be reversed based on the plain meaning of entitlement to benefits under Part A and this court's Hall versus Sebelius decision. And That is our position on the statutory interpretation issue. And we certainly think it is a step one argument on entitled to benefits under Part A. At the very least, the Secretary's interpretation is reasonable, entitled to broad deference. The District Court also erred. If you agree with us on Part 1, you don't even need to reach the District Court's retroactivity holding because Congress has made clear that these days belong in the Medicare SSI fraction. If not, and you do need to reach the retroactivity...
That's an interesting question. Suppose the agency had consistently interpreted it in a clear fashion, no question, contrary to your Step 1 interpretation. And then someday you have a lawyer who says, you know, we've been wrong about this. Congress was quite clear, so we switch our position. Is there a retroactivity issue then, if you do it by rule?
Certainly we can change a rule by notice and comment and rulemaking, though if there is a...
But do you have a retroactivity question then?
Your Honor, I think here, because the plaintiffs...
Just answer my hypothetical. Do you understand? Did you follow? Should I say it again?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's assume you have an absolutely crystal clear Step 1 Chevron interpretation of the statute. Yet the agency took a different position for some time. And then by rules, they think to themselves, hey, we were wrong. This Congress was perfectly clear. And they publish a new rule saying, this is the way we're going to interpret it. Do they have a retroactivity problem with respect to companies that were, or any company or hospital that was paying based on the old position?
I don't think so, because if it's a step one, where Congress made clear all along from the beginning how it
should... Yeah, but the agency, under my hypothetical, the agency misunderstood it for 10 years.
In your hypothetical, it may... Now, it...
You just assumed...
You just assumed away
this hypothetical, and I wondered why.
Because in this case, the hospital itself... challenge.
No, but you say if it's step one, that's the end of the case.
We're not saying it. I think if the agency was correcting something going forward to be consistent with what Congress meant to happen, then for any open cases, that could apply. It doesn't mean that the Secretary could go back 10 years for a closed cost report that no one ever appealed and...
That's not my hypothetical. My concern is that now a new rule that recognizes that we were wrong about the interpretation of the statute. The statute means A, and we've always applied it as B. Now we're going to issue a new rule that establishes that it's A. Can we apply that retroactively, even if we were for some time operating contrary to that?
Your Honor, I think...
Is there any case on that? Do you have any precedent for that? Do you still have a retroactivity problem?
Not with respect to any pending case in court or before the agency, no. But I do...
Why not?
Because here...
Why not? Why don't you have a retroactivity problem?
Because Congress, if a hospital has put at issue the very question that Congress directly addressed and has asked for here, they asked for days to be put in the Medicaid fraction. Now, again, as we argued in our brief, it is not at all retroactive to exclude them. But assuming what we're saying, but assuming that it were, because the hospital here filed an appeal, put at issue their DSH adjustment, and if this court ruled that Congress precluded inclusion of those days in the Medicaid fraction, even if we were doing that wrongly,
You may be right, because I don't think there's any case law. And it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, this court actually, in the Monmouth case, this court applied that against the secretary in a sense, in the way that the secretary had a prior interpretation, had thought that it was at least a permissible interpretation, four courts ruled against it, and the secretary purported that it was going to acquiesce prospectively, and the court allowed mandamus and essentially interpreted the agency's ruling to acquiesce in the decisions as saying its prior interpretation was invalid.
I see. I know what you're saying. It just really isn't responsive to my question, but it's interesting. Now, the other thing that sort of puzzles me, the agency's change in position, it didn't come in a rule, did it?
There has been no change of position.
Well, I didn't mean to say change of position. The agency's present position was not adopted in a rule. It was adopted in an adjudication, wasn't it? In the 2000 or my?
Yes. There had been no definitive agency policy or interpretation.
He's not trying to trick you here. What he's really just asking is this is an adjudication, not a rulemaking, isn't it?
On the Medicaid fraction, yes. In 2000.
Yes.
And now,
however,
the retroactivity question is a little different. I was a little puzzled why you didn't bring that out on your brief, because there is. In the Boeing case, the Supreme Court specifically said a rule will not be presumed to be retroactive unless Congress explicitly says that. Adjudications, however, are by definition retroactive. So I don't quite understand. Now, you still may have a question of equity, a sort of an equitable question, whether a rule that changes a prior position should be applied in a fashion to impose a penalty. That's a somewhat different issue, and so I'm a little puzzled at why you were talking about this as if it was the rule that was argued to be retroactive. Which is it that it's your adjudication that it was? But you don't make that clear in your brief.
Well, I think with respect to the Medicaid fraction, the first definitive interpretation was in 2000 in an adjudication.
Right.
And then in 2004, the agency actually, by notice and comment rulemaking, changed its interpretation of the Medicare SSI fraction so that now those days will be included in that fraction.
You're guessing that we're going in a different direction than we're actually going. So this case, with respect to this fraction, has been decided only in this adjudication, correct? I appreciate you think there's previous statements that are consistent with it, but it's done in an adjudication. Let me just lay out the whole argument so you'll understand where we're all going here. So both of the briefs say that the test for retroactivity is whether the new rule is substantively inconsistent, or the new interpretation, with the established practice. That is the test for rulemaking. That is not the test for adjudication. The test for adjudication is better for you than that test, because it is presumed that adjudications will be retroactive. And in those, the test is whether the new law is substituted for something that was reasonably clear, and as Judge Silberman is getting at, whether there's an equitable component of settled expectations. So what we're asking is, shouldn't we be applying a standard that is better for you than the one that both sides have been arguing in the brief?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I think you clearly can do that with respect to this case, because even the district court found that in 2000 there was an adjudication which reflected the fact that these would not be included in the Medicaid fraction. The 2004 rulemaking did address the issue, you know, in a notice and comment rulemaking, in that the agency decided to include these days in the Medicare SSI fraction and continue to not include them in the Medicaid fraction.
But no one's challenging, they are not challenging that, that rulemaking, right?
No, Your Honor, I don't think they're challenging the rulemaking. I mean, they originally, when they brought the suit, challenged this under Chevron step one, but I don't see them as bringing that challenge in light of this court's ruling in Northeast. But I hear the they have challenged it as unreasonable under Chevron step two. But for all of the reasons we've given in our brief, it's the interpretation is consistent with the plain language, and it is consistent with congressional intent.
What about these various citations that the other side provides, which they contend indicate that you've changed your position?
Those do, and especially under the easier test for the adjudication, that certainly would not rise to the level of the type of definitive agency interpretation that would cause a retroactivity problem. The first source cited by the district court and plaintiff is a sentence in introductory language in 1995 and 1996 rulemakings, which did not address the question of whether dual eligible beneficiaries are entitled to benefits under Part A. They addressed different issues, and it was introductory language, and it's just essentially its reliance on a stray sentence in a rulemaking that didn't address the matter. The same is true of the Presbyterian case, the administrator decision, and we included all the administrator
sentence at the end.
A stray sentence at the end of that one, Your Honor.
And what about their reliance on the rural hospital provision?
The rural hospital position, that provision, Your Honor, the secretary did in 2010 change her interpretation to make it consistent with what Congress intended entitled to benefits under Part A to mean. And as the plaintiff in the Sixth Circuit Metro Hospital case had also brought up that same rural hospital provision, Your Honor, and what the Sixth Circuit said is that the 2010 amendment further demonstrates that the Secretary's interpretation of this statutory phrase, entitled to benefits under Part A, is the product of a reasoned analysis of its terms. The Secretary is now making that the interpretation of all these various parts of the Medicare statute now reflects Congress's intent that entitled to benefits under Part A refers to legal status.
So the district court commented on the fact that the government couldn't point to any clear statement anywhere.
And Your Honor, the clear statement we have is in the adjudication in the Edgewater case.
Well, what I'm getting at is, I mean, the record before us is apparently the system's out of control because hospitals are being paid for things that you're arguing now. Congress clearly said it was impermissible. And we have these amici briefs saying that, you know, this interpretation supports the challenge here. That maybe they were wrong, but it's back to Judge Silverman's hypothetical question to you. And so here the point is it doesn't really matter that for years we've allowed this to happen in a different way. If Congress has said you can't do it, that's the end of the discussion. So under Judge Garland's articulation of this test, what are the equitable considerations and how do they factor in?
Your Honor, first, in light, I think you're referring to Southwest Consulting's amicus brief. That is extra record material.
But record material here by others saying that some of these payments were being made.
The Medicaid fraction is calculated by fiscal intermediaries, and there may have been fiscal intermediaries who, you know, included Medicaid days in error, but that if you look at the Secretary's...
So there is no equitable consideration here? I'm just trying to be clear on the test.
Well, here the days were excluded. They were, and that's why this plaintiff is bringing this appeal. And if you look at our list of related cases, there are quite a few hospitals in it, and the related cases,
So there are no equitable considerations. That's what I'm trying to get you to focus on. Because they were denied. And they had no basis for thinking they should have been entitled.
That's right. That's right, because there was nothing they can point to in the years at issue issued by the agency, such as a rule, a regulation, a policy statement, anything of the sort. So no, there are no equitable considerations for this.
So what about our cases that talk about a situation where the government today argues that the language is crystal clear and everybody should have known, but at least until Edgewater and Castle, the government had, secretary had never addressed the question. And, you know, what is entitled to mean? It's you say it's plain on its face, but obviously not everybody thought it was. Does that factor in at all here as to the retroactivity analysis?
No, Your Honor, because, again, if Congress made it clear, it doesn't even matter what the secretary thought at the time, so long as the secretary didn't issue something upon which plaintiffs relied to their detriment. And here,
well,
plaintiffs
they provided these services. They weren't getting reimbursed otherwise.
Well, Your Honor, again, they're not... There is nothing that shows that they were generally, that generally these days were left out of the Medicaid fraction, not put in. There may have been some mistakes made, but it's also important to know that here, plaintiff's interpretation would actually hurt some hospitals. In the 2004-
Before you get into the policy, isn't the issue here that this argument turns the standard of review upside down, that if it's not clear at all, you have to win because it's an adjudication and you're perfectly entitled for the first time in an adjudication to apply a rule and apply it retroactively. It's only if they can show that it's reasonably clear that we then even consider the equitable issues with respect to retroactive adjudications. So unless they can show it was clear, reasonably clear, you're home free here. So the real question is, has there been a policy in which the agency has consistently or reasonably intermittently allowed these payments? And I take it your answer is that there hasn't been. Is that right? And there's never been an appeal from any of these intermediaries that got to CMS or any part of HHS in which the agency has okayed an intermediary's payment. Is that right?
That's right. There's the statement, I mean, Reed and the Sixth Circuit agreed with us that the statement in Presbyterian was not a statement of policy or
it wasn't, just so I'm clear.
What the administrator was focused on there was purely whether or not the days were paid by Medicaid. There wasn't any thought or in, you know, they clearly did not address whether if coverage is exhausted that particular beneficiary would be entitled to part to benefits under Part A. And I also would like to refer the court to our reply brief where we cited briefs filed in the courts of appeals and other cases where our argument was in 1995 and 96, before this case, was entirely consistent about the meaning of entitled to benefits under Part A.
And just the Cable Huntington case and the legacy Emanuel case.
Yes, and we had a notice and comment regulation promulgated in 1983 about the meaning of entitled, which is completely consistent with the position taken in this case. So no, Your Honor, they have not come close to meeting their burden on retroactivity.
Further questions? All right, we'll hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Keough, representing Appellee, Catholic Health Initiatives, Mercy Medical Center. I'll start with the retroactivity point. Beginning with the implementation of the DISH statutes and the implementing regulation in 1986, there was a policy, there was a practice. It was consistent, it was uniform, it was the only way it could be, and that is these dual eligible exhausted benefit days were always counted in the Medicaid fraction.
By whom? By
the fiscal intermediaries that contract with the Secretary, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
By the contractors called fiscal intermediaries.
I know who they are. But do you have any statement by the Secretary or any adjudication? Why don't you go to those?
I'll start at the beginning, if I may. In the May 1986 interim final rule, in the regulation text, the Secretary defined the numerator of the Medicaid fraction to consist of days for patients who were, quote, entitled to Medicaid but not Medicare Part A, two-part test. In the preamble accompanying that May 1986 interim final rule, and the site is 51 Federal Register 16777, in the middle column, the Secretary interpreted that very phrase, entitled to Medicaid but not benefits under Medicare Part A. And the Secretary said three things. These days will, one, be determined by the intermediaries. Two, based on the statistics reported in the Medicare cost report. And three, the count of Medicaid days for the DISH calculation shall include all Medicaid covered days. All, no exceptions. It doesn't say all Medicaid covered paid days except those for Medicare Part A exhausted benefits.
Maybe that's only a description of the first part of the fraction that is eligible for medical assistance under Medicaid.
But, Your Honor, I suppose anything's possible, except that's the definition of the whole phrase, entitled to Medicaid but not benefits under Medicare Part A. That's the lead-in to that whole two sentences. Likewise, in the 1987 Medicare cost report instructions, came out the next year, which is in the record. It's in the hospital addendum beginning at page 24A. There are instructions for completion of the form, the cost report form that contains the statistics that are used for all purposes on the cost report, including the DISH calculation. And right on the first page of those instructions, section 1906, there's a note set off in block quotes at the middle of the page. It says, note, colon, under section 1886 D5F, that's the Medicare DISH statute, the count of Medicaid days in the DISH calculation includes all Medicaid covered days. Your Honor, on that form, on the cost report form, there's no place, there's not only no instruction, there's no place on the form for subtracting from the number of Medicaid covered days anything, including without limitation Medicare Part A exhausted days. The Secretary knows this. The Secretary knows those days were counted from the beginning. The PRRB, in this case, I'm sorry, the Provider Reimbursement Review Board, in this case, made a finding on that very point, that the policy and the practice consistently from 1986 to 2004 was to include these days in the Medicaid fraction. And I would note, in reviewing the administrator's decision in this case, the administrator doesn't say anything about that practice or the policy. The administrator just immediately goes to, I guess what we would call plain language construction of the DISH statute in 2010 as categorically foreclosing these days. The Presbyterian case, of course, in 1996, is a decision that perfectly reflects that policy and practice. The administrator and the board both ruled, of course, that those days that were billed and paid by Medicaid after Part A benefits were exhausted should be included in the Medicaid fraction. Now, the administrator didn't need to spend much time on that, and neither did the board, because that was the plain practice. The only reason that issue came up in that case at all, it was the second issue in the case, and by the way, I would respectfully disagree with the Sixth Circuit's decision that there was only one issue in Presbyterian and it was a different one. Respectfully, there were two issues. This one only came up in the case because these particular days had been billed to and paid by Medicaid after Part A benefits were exhausted later in time, after the intermediary had done its initial payment, audit, and settlement of the submitted cost report. And sometimes these billing things take a period of time. You've got to figure out, is Medicare benefits available and have they been exhausted? And then it gets billed later, long, sometimes months and months after the end of the fiscal year, to Medicaid, and then Medicaid makes a determination on the claim. It can take a while. The only reason these came up on the appeal in 1996 is because they weren't in the original cost report filing due to that timing discrepancy. There is no other case until we get to Edgewater involving this issue in the history of the PRRB.
What about the two?
Until we get to Edgewater and Castle, yes.
What about the two 95 and 96 Court of Appeals briefs?
Your Honor, I think those I would characterize as something akin to agency counsel dicta on cases not concerning the Medicare fraction, concerning, as the Sixth Circuit noted, concerning the Medicaid fraction, and concerning an issue that's not in play with respect to the Medicare fraction in those cases. In the 1986 rule, as in the 1990 rule, construing the Medicare dependent statute, which uses the same phrase, entitled to benefits under Part A, the Secretary gave no shrift at all to this parenthetical phrase, for such days. The only time that didn't even come up in the Edgewater and Castle decisions. The first time that rationale ever came about were in the decisions like the decision in this case, issued after the 2004 regulation, and in an attempt to explain post-2004 why the Secretary could maintain both positions at the same time, that these days had never been counted in the SSI fraction, yet they should also be excluded from the Medicaid fraction. But the reality was, and had to be, these days were always counted in the Medicaid fraction prior to the 2004 rule change. Now,
Counsel, if we get to the equitable question,
yes.
It's not the retroactivity of a rulemaking. What are the equities on your side?
Boy,
what,
Your Honor,
how did you rely to your detriment?
If Mercy Medical Center doesn't have equities on its side in this case, I don't know any party that ever would. These two patients that make up the days at issue here were admitted to the hospital in 1992. Very, very sick. The discharge notes redacted are in the record, but suffice to say, that goes on for pages, they had many problems, internal systems failures, complications. It went on for years. They died in 1997 in the hospital. Medicare came in and paid for a little bit, about 150 days, and then that tapped out. Medicaid came in and made payment for a number of the days for one of the two patients, but not the other, although they were Medicaid eligible.
No, my question is, how did you react to your detriment?
What was your reliance? The hospital treated these patients.
You wouldn't have treated them otherwise?
In part, there's an expectation, I think fairly on the hospital's part. They've received whatever standardized DRG payment they would have received under the Medicare program directly for the initial part of the stay, but they're entitled to a DSH payment.
The
DSH payment doesn't come until later.
I think the question Judge Silberman is asking, or would your hospital have thrown them out if they had known that...
I'm sure they would not, Your Honor.
Right, so the question, the equitable... Of course. There's no doubt that's your answer. But that cuts against the reliance interest here.
I think they are entitled to rely, on the original rule established. The 1986 rule is not unclear. And the September rule is to the same effect as the May.
I'll just footnote, I don't think you have to concede the factual point that Judge Garland's question presumes, because at least based on experience here in the District of Columbia, as to how these non-covered patients were being shifted from hospital to hospital, it's not clear that they would have received treatment necessarily.
Well, and the hospital would have had an expectation of receiving, for the fiscal year of discharge, which in this case is 1997, the Medicare DSH payment. It gets separated and it gets delayed because you hold everything until the patient's discharged for Medicare DSH. And they included these days in the 1997 cost report in 96. And they were allowed. and final determinations issued in 1998 and 1999. Then this Edgewater decision comes out. It's absolutely false. It says these days are always counted in the SSI fraction because they're in time. That's wrong. In 2002, in follow-up to that decision,
so your quarrel is with the Edgewater decision. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I missed your question.
Your quarrel is with the Edgewater decision.
Yes, yes.
Not a rule.
That's correct. I think
it's not clear in the briefs.
Well, and our point, Your Honor, is that the Edgewater decision, it says what it says, but it's nothing more than an invalid agency action. It's contrary to the agency's interpretation of the statute and regs at the time, as well as its actual practice. But on the equity point, Your Honor, if I may wrap it up quickly. 2002, there's a reopening following Edgewater, and the hospital appeals. The hospital appeals gets from the agency the data from the agency's calculation of the SSI fraction that the hospital wouldn't otherwise have in a discovery-type production, and proves, hey, these patients aren't in that fraction, and neither is anybody else that Medicare Part A didn't make payment for. Based on that, the contractor then settles that appeal in 2004, and then this is probably where the 2004 rule comes back in, Your Honor, and I apologize for the confusion, but then later in 2004, the intermediary comes back yet again, reopens again, explicitly invoking the 2004 rulemaking, and says, these days come back out. That's got to be retroactive, in my view. And it is a substantive change. It's a substantive change from the practice, in effect, before 2004. It's also, Your Honor, a substantive change from the policy. The government's counsel has picked nits with various statements that Chief Judge Lamberth noted in his opinion. But I'll take one. The 1995 Federal Register statement. That's where, in the Federal Register, the Secretary described the calculation of the two fractions, and I'll use a shorthand reference, in reference to Medicare Part A covered days. And it defined, if I may paraphrase, the SSI fraction as including Medicare Part A covered days, and it defined the Medicaid fraction as excluding Medicare Part A covered days. Now, that very statement, which the counsel now says, well, I don't know what the secretary was talking about there. She was addressing a different subject. That's cited in the administrator's decision in this case as a statement of the agency's prior policy. But there's a problem with the administrator's decision in this case. It cites that 1995 policy on page 28 of the joint appendix. Two pages later, on page 30 of the joint appendix, the administrator in this case goes on to note, well, you know, we never really did count these exhausted benefit days in the SSI fraction. That's because they weren't covered. Well, the logical inference here is if they weren't included, and they never were, in the SSI fraction because they weren't Medicare Part A covered, they also weren't ever excluded from the Medicaid fraction for that same reason. And counsel now says, well, but that 1995 statement, it was loosely worded, wasn't given much thought, but the administrator cites it in this very decision for a statement of the agency's prior policy. We submit, Your Honor, this retroactive rulemaking. In answer to Judge Silverman's question earlier on
the statute. Retroactive rulemaking.
Retroactive application.
Adjudication.
Change from the policy and practice in effect.
In an adjudication.
Right.
But you're saying it's impermissible.
Impermissible.
Yes.
That's right. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, you asked about the situation where the government's counsel is now arguing the statute has a plain meaning which compels the one applied here. Policy and practice were different earlier. I would perhaps point to two decisions that, if not exactly on point, I think are very helpful on this point. And one is the Supreme Court's decision in Bowen v. Georgetown, where the...
Bowen deals with a rulemaking. And concern is whether a rulemaking can be applied retroactively.
I understand. I only pointed out for the one point that The court concluded on page 212 of that decision that the arguments of counsel in that case as to the plain meaning of the statute, which had never been adopted in any rule by the agency, were entitled to little to no weight, for what it's worth. And I think the Supreme Court in Investment Company Institute v. Camp, 401 U.S. 617, has said something similar. It is the administrative official and not appellate counsel who possesses the expertise that can enlighten and rationalize the search for the meaning and intent of Congress. And at that point, I would come back to this court's decision in Northeast. And this court in Northeast accepted the Secretary's argument in that case that the DISH statute's ambiguous. And I think the court made a few points that are worth bringing out here. One, that this is a statute addressed to specialists. Two, this is a statute that contains varying and inconsistent usages of the term entitled or entitled to benefits under Part A. And this is a statute.
Pause over that. How does it help you if we have to go to Chevron Step 2 rather than Chevron Step 1? That is, in Northeast, we said it was ambiguous and therefore proceed to Chevron Step 2.
Although we didn't get to Chevron Step 2 based on the retroactivity problem.
Well, I understand.
Yes.
So is that the only issue, the retroactivity then? I mean, in Northeast, we said that even somebody who had opted for coverage under Medicare Part C and therefore couldn't have gotten benefits under Part A, it would still be permissible, we said, to include it, to be counted, to not be counted. Permissible to say that a patient was entitled to benefits under Part A even when they had opted for coverage under Medicare Part C and therefore no longer
received. In terms of the plain language of the statute, I think the court concluded that the statute didn't foreclose that.
Correct.
I do think the court didn't reach the Chevron Step 2.
But we did say it was a permissible reading. We didn't reach the end because it was retroactive. Which is where your argument here comes
from. Judge Kavanaugh, writing separately, had concluded, in fact, the opposite, that the statute
normally two beats one, so.
Understood. I think for additional reasons, many of which Judge Kavanaugh ticked off in his concurring opinion, the current interpretation, even if it weren't retroactive, would not be reasonable. And one is the inherent inconsistencies, and some of these have already been addressed in Northeast in our briefs, but, you know, for 20 years, the Secretary construed not only the Medicare DISH statute use of the term entitled to benefits Part A, but also the same phrase used in the immediately adjacent provision, both as referring to entitled to payment. And the Secretary never changed the interpretation of the Medicare dependent add-on provision until 2010, after Judge Bates had ruled in the district court on the Northeast case, when that payment provision had just 2 years of life left. And even when the agency did that, Your Honor, the agency didn't say the statute, wherever it uses the term entitled to benefits under Part A, always means legal status. The Secretary at that time said, well, we think this better conforms the regulations to the text. The agency has never, ever, anywhere articulated or adopted the argument counsel makes here, which is that the term entitled to benefits Part A, wherever used, always means status. This is an appellate, and this was the point of my earlier mention of Bowen and the Investment Company Institute case, that this is an appellate counsel argument, which to my vantage point looks like sort of an 11th hour Hail Mary to avoid a retroactivity problem. It's advancing an interpretation of a vast, complicated, specialized statute that the agency itself has never taken.
Well, you're clearly right that on the first step of Chevron, we don't defer, because the question about first step of Chevron is it plain? If it's plain, there would be no reason to defer. So the deference question only comes into the second step. Here, the agency has told us, as an agency, what they think is a meaning.
And I think certainly as a technically that's absolutely correct, Your Honor, although I would urge it should perhaps be some pause given when the agency itself has never articulated nor adopted the always everywhere interpretation that the appellate counsel argues here. As the court noted in Northeast at page 17, the Secretary herself has read the phrase entitled to mean different things in different places of the Medicare statute, including within the two Part B provisions in 1395L that they've cited in their briefs here. As we've pointed out in our brief, those provisions, with both which both contain two clauses, the second of which refers to patients who are not so entitled, and the agency reads that phrase as referring not to individuals who are not or never had been enrolled in Part A, but to folks who are enrolled in Part A and are in a hospital stay, but they're in a stay that's not covered for reasons like medical necessity. There are many other provisions of the statute where, again, as this Court noted in Northeast, the Secretary, the agency itself, has not adopted the always, everywhere interpretation urged here in the briefs in court. I notice I've passed my time.
Further questions?
Unless there are further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Does the government have any time left? All right, we'll give you 2 minutes, one of which I'm going to use up on the following question. What is your answer to opposing counsel's discussion of the 1987 cost report instructions?
Your Honor, I don't see anywhere in those instructions anything that addresses dual eligible days.
Well, he says it asks for all Medicaid covered days and provides no place for a subtraction.
Your Honor, I don't think that you can read into instructions like that that don't even talk about the issue of a dual eligible beneficiary, any kind of agency interpretation that would cause reliance. Similarly, counsel was relying on the 1986 rulemaking, which also did not address this and just referred to the fact that the secretary originally construed the Medicaid fraction as including only covered Medicaid days. The district court rejected the reliance. Even though the district court ruled for plaintiff, it didn't rely on the 1986 rulemaking. On page 102 of the joint appendix, 13 of the district court opinion, the district court explains that the 1986 rulemaking does not cover this. I think neither the 1986 rulemaking nor the instructions, which don't rise to the level of a rulemaking in any event, do not address this issue.
And the 1995 registration statement that he addressed?
Again,
Federal Register statement.
So. Federal Register statement, yes, Your Honor. And I think it makes absolutely no difference that that is cited in the administrator opinion here. That sentence does accurately reflect that at that time, the secretary was only counting days on which Medicaid paid for a patient day. You can have a patient who is eligible for Medicaid in the same way that someone is entitled to Medicare and the program doesn't pay for that day. That interpretation has since been rejected, but that's what that sentence referred to. And the secretary acknowledges that because of the parenthetical for such days, which modifies eligible for Medicaid in the Medicaid fraction and entitled to benefits under Part A only in the Medicare SSI fraction, she formerly interpreted the for such days clause as a restrictive clause, but as the 1983 definition of entitled reveals, as the 1995 and 96 briefs filed in the courts of appeals reveal, as the administrator opinions, the administrator decisions in Edgewater and Castle, which notably address cost years prior to 1997. So clearly the fact that there was this 2000 decision, but it was addressing cost years before 1997. So there was another hospital who had here, there clearly the administrator in 2000 thought it appropriate, and there was nothing that would have prohibited the agency from excluding these in cost years such as 1992.
So that's the plain language source?
The plain language source?
In effect.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. In other words,
the plaintiff's argument is Edgewater was just wrong. And so was Castle, because it was built on a false premise.
Yes, I I understand that there was a false premise on the practice of the agency or the agency's policy with respect to whether the days were included in the Medicare fraction, but respectfully, there wasn't an error by the administrator in what entitled to benefits under Part A meant in both fractions. And that is why we cited that brief to the court from 1995, because it so explicitly explains what the agency has always thought. It cites the 1983.
We would have to read that brief very carefully. No, I'm serious.
Yeah, no.
Because the district court's whole point was that the agency had never clearly stated anywhere, you know, what now is so clear that everybody should have understood from the beginning.
And part of the Your Honor, there was this confusion because of the four such days modifier. And if you look at those briefs, you'll see that despite the very clear description of what the Secretary's interpretation of entitled to benefits is, it says, the brief says, okay, the Medicare fraction then uses four such days.
Yeah, but that's a brief filed by counsel.
Yeah.
The question is, what has the Secretary said officially?
Was
the district court's point.
But the 1983 regulation actually says that entitled means that an individual meets all the requirements for Medicare benefits. That's cited in our brief. It's in the addendum.
Right. And the only point is that if the whole practice is saying that's true, but the question is, are these hospitals getting paid?
Well, Your Honor.
So the world was going on that premise, and then Edgewater comes along, and of course the argument here is, well, Edgewater can be retroactive, and Mercy loses. But
there also, it's notable that in the 2004 rulemaking, the agency noted that numerous commenters were against including these days in the Medicaid fraction.
That's a different issue.
Well, but just to show, in terms of reliance, there are hospitals that would not get paid because they have patients who are entitled to SSI but not eligible for Medicaid.
That was my comment about the real world and what these hospitals do to avoid these patients, all right? So I understand that, you know, depending on which way the Secretary rules, hospitals can benefit or not. So I'm just clear as to, is it that the administrator denies that this practice was going on? See, that's what I'm trying to understand. It's fine for the administrator to say, I always thought it was clear. And the fact that, you know, my delegates may not have been as clear about it, that's just tough, because Congress was clear, and that's my position.
Your Honor, I don't think that the administrator ever administrator's only mistake was saying that these days had been included in the Medicare fraction. Right. That certain fiscal intermediaries may have included them, but there wasn't any regulation that told them to do so. There wasn't any rulemaking. Again, there's no policy statement.
Well, that's the point about you can interpret it various ways, and.
But if that there, I think that if unless plaintiff can come up with some kind of,
well, that's the issue. Isn't
if
it?
The burden is the on burden? The yeah. burden is on the plaintiff, and as the court pointed out, even more so because it's an adjudication. And I think that we would win on the rulemaking also for the reasons stated in our brief. But they have even more of a burden, and they have not met that there.
Is there?
Well, all I'm trying to draw is a distinction between you have distinguished every piece of formal statement that they have cited.
Yes.
But you have not denied that there was this pattern in practice.
Well, Your Honor, we haven't acknowledged it either. It's not, again,
that's the way they're making their case. They say there's this pattern in practice, and we have, these are my words, not their words, but, you know, these indicators, snippets, although they be. And you come back and say, no, we have other snippets. You know, we file these briefs, you know, we didn't mean what we said in Presbyterian, et cetera. That's what
Well, and there are also these appeals by hospitals who did not get their days included in the Medicaid fraction. So that is further evidence that it certainly wasn't some, you know, some practice on behalf of all FIs that these were included.
But it is interesting that you have a system like this where there are hundreds of thousands of people being affected, where there is no clear statement. And, okay, somebody appeals and they lose, but what about everybody else? I mean, that's the interesting thing to me about running this system, if this is such a critical issue.
And Your Honor, I think, you know, that there, that it is a critical issue. What has been, and it may be one of the few things that is clear in this case, but what has been clear in this case is what entitled means under the Medicare statute. And in...
To some people,
yes. And that ambiguities came from other parts of the for such days clause with respect to the covered days point. And in Northeast, the fact that there were provisions of the Medicare statute that this court cited that refers to once you sign up for Part C, your benefits are administered under Part C. So the question is whether it's actually paid on, you know, under Part C. So here you don't have that ambiguity. These individuals are, you know, they're clearly, their entitlement is under Part A, and the fact that they've exhausted coverage does not mean they're no longer entitled to benefits. The benefit itself is defined in the statute as subject to the limitations of Part A.
Judge Rogers referred to a practice of making payments. Is there evidence in the record of a practice?
No, Your Honor. There was an amicus brief that said in our experience.
An amicus brief in this court?
In this court.
Was there an amicus brief in the district court?
Not to my knowledge.
So there's no evidence in the record about a practice by the intermediaries. Is that right?
Before the district court. There certainly is no evidence of any kind of, you know, widespread practice.
Evidence of a practice? Counsel
no.
has represented to us this morning that there was such evidence of a practice.
Well,
was it in the record before the district court? And if not, should we send this case back to the district?
No, Your Honor, you do not need to do that. We think, again, because there is, that, you know, again, if it's Chevron step one, that this is a clear meaning of entitled, there is nothing, if a fiscal intermediary made a mistake on occasion. Now here—
That's not really the question we're asking. The question is there evidence in the district court record? If there isn't, it's too late for somebody to put it in now. It has nothing to do with whether it's plain or not. The only question is, was there evidence, if they are making an argument that this is inconsistent with a widespread practice, there must be evidence in the record other than their statements that there was. And we're asking you, is there such evidence?
No,
All right, I'm actually going to ask.
It's actually a helpful question,
right.
Counsel.
Yes.
You should be quite
no. Right, they made the same kind of arguments they're making here, but there's no actual evidence of a practice.
Further questions? Question.
Well, I'd like to ask counsel for Appley then, just so I'm clear, as to what was in the district court record regarding the pattern and practice. Because the district court made references to something that...
The PRRB, comprised of five members who are experts in this area, accountants, lawyers, required by statute to be experienced, made a specific finding in this case, that the agency had a policy and a practice from 1986 to 1994.
So it's that finding by the
finding, board. Not disturbed by the administrator.
All right. And the administrator just ignored it.
Just ignored it.
All
and
right.
Two, I will, the 1986 regulation, which I won't...
No, I'm not asking for more argument.
No, but I just want to go to the cost report instructions. There is nothing
that's
on
really,
that form.
I think it's clear that's not really what we're asking you about. But
right.
But can you tell us the page of the PRRB where that was said?
Yes. In the joint appendix?
Yes.
Page 47, as well as the top of 47, I think also the bottom of joint appendix page 45.
Thank you.
And one last thing, Your Honor. We had a similar argument with the government in the Northeast case about policy and practice.
I thought you were given an opportunity by the presiding judge to answer one question.
I hope this answers that question, Your Honor.
I think you're going to a second question, aren't you?
Well,
you're going to say that the similar arguments were made in that case. We recall.
Yes, and this court, on page 17 of its decision, looked to these cases at the board, that are challenging the ruling that they cite to, where they say they never counted the days in the Medicaid fraction. One of those two decisions cited in this court's decision in Northeast recants that with respect to the days at issue here, the hospitals had presented evidence that they were always
counting. We're beyond the scope of a surrebuttal if there were such a thing as a surrebuttal. We'll take the matter under consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.